There was nowhere to go. Consequently, it was a bedraggled and none too happy army that limped into camp below the redoubt. Some units stayed firm, particularly the companies formed of pirates and the volunteers who had followed Varkash to defend their homeland. Others were far less resolute, and many soon began agitating for immediate evacuation from the peninsula.
"Pick out the biggest loudmouths and put them in front of a firing squad,"
Varkash suggested at the Council of War Lazan convened at the redoubt.
"Or hang them if you'd rather save the ammunition."
"That will set the whole army to riot," Arberus said. "A few days of rest and decent food will do much to restore their discipline."
"If the spoiled will give us that long," Alzar said. "Besides which, cowards they may be, but it doesn't make them wrong. If we couldn't stand against the monsters at the sands, how can we stand against them here?"
Arberus began to reply, but Lazan caught his eye and shook her head.
"We can't," she told them. "Not indefinitely. But General Arberus assures me that we can hold out for several days, perhaps longer, and it is important that we do so."
"Why?" Alzar asked. "We can transport the army to Iskemir, gather more strength."
"Leaving the White to advance into the heart of the peninsula," Lizan said, "where there are far more people than we could ever hope to evacuate. Once there, the White can gather an army so great, there will be no force in this world that can stop it. We have to hold here for as long as we can."
She paused, unsure of how to explain her reasoning. She was asking a great deal of these people. Many would die if they continued to follow her lead, but many more might live.
"A man is coming here," she said. "A bloodblessed, bearing a new weapon found in the Eratian interior. Something that can kill the White."
"What kind of weapon?" Alzar demanded. "And why haven't we heard of this before?"
"Because the White knows the secrets of every human it makes into a monster," Lizan replied. "Which is why I will not tell you the nature of this weapon. Suffice to say that if we can keep the White's attention on us for the next month, we have a chance to end this."
"We wounded them badly at the sands," Arberus added. "They'll be more wary of us now, more cautious, and a cautious enemy is a slow enemy."
Alzar's doubts were plain, but he gave a slow nod.
"Very well. I'll take a tour of the camp, speak to these malcontents, see if I can't harden a few hearts. My lot will happily form the firing squad if you can't,"
Varkash offered.
"Good to see time has done a lot to mellow your soul,"
Alzar observed dryly. Lazan expected Varkash to bridle at this, but he just laughed.
"What use is a mellow soul in an age such as this?"
Chapter 45. Cirrus. The glass crunched under his boots as he strode to the center of the near-perfect circle blasted into the jet sands.
"Hotter than a furnace,"
he concluded, crouching to retrieve a shard of the glass produced by the heat of the explosion. He found the way it caught the light oddly beautiful, resembling obsidian in its lack of transparency. Casting his gaze around, he could find no corpses within this circle, despite Veilmist's estimate that over 3,000 spoiled had died at this very spot. The blast and the heat had been so powerful, they had simply been vaporized. The first explosion hadn't been so well placed, claiming only about 2,000 spoiled, but together they had sown enough disruption in the advance to make his victory a flawed one. Moradin would have been spitting bile, he thought with a grim smile, tossing the shard of glass away and rising as Kathleen spoke in his head.
"He's ready," she told him. "Best if you hurry. I've no idea how long he'll last." The captive was the only survivor of the airship the Reds had brought down, plucked from the sands with near-fatal burns, multiple broken bones and crushed organs. Reasoning that a small experiment would cost nothing, Cirrus had taken him to the Blue Crystal. After the conversion, many of his injuries remained beyond repair, but his brain was still intact. "Where are the airships made?" Cirrus inquired, staring down at the lopsided face of the newly fashioned spoiled. The fall had robbed him of a cheekbone and one of his eyes, in addition to shattering his jaw, but Cirrus didn't need to hear him talk.
"Aerostats," the spoiled corrected, his thoughts possessed of a surprising coherence.
A brief rummage through the man's memories revealed him to be a former locomotive driver, with a level of technical understanding Cirrus would be sorry to lose.
"They are manufactured at a place called the Mount Works," the spoiled went on, "along with many other weapons."
Cirrus felt a flare of excitement from Kathleen, one he couldn't help but share. He summoned a mental map of the Verestian Peninsula and pushed it into the spoiled's mind, along with a question.
"Where is it?"
"You shouldn't be risking yourself like this," Kathleen had said, as he climbed onto Katarius's back.
She reached out to him as he settled between the spines, one hand clutching her shawl about her shoulders whilst she grasped his forearm. He supposed that to an ignorant observer, they might have made a romantic tableau, the hero being sent off to war by his beautiful, golden-haired paramour. But he wasn't a hero. He was a monster, and Kathleen, in any way that mattered, was far from beautiful.
"The mission is crucial," he replied. "The outcome must be certain. I need to lead in person."
She didn't object, the White's approval overriding any objections she might harbor. Osiris was struck by the anguish evident in her face.
"If you don't come back,"
she began, then faltered before continuing.
"It will be difficult."
"Veil Mist will make an adequate replacement," he said.
She looked up, meeting his gaze, red-black eyes wide and expression devoid of the arch cynicism he had come to expect.
"That's not what I meant."
Katarius banked steeply to avoid a thick patch of cloud, bringing Cirrus back to the present with a jolt. Looking down, he could see the two moons reflected on a calm sea, meaning they had crossed the coastline north of Blaska Sound. He had opted to cover much of the distance in an overland flight, avoiding the many eyes of the Verestian fleet, whilst also affording the Reds the opportunity to rest along the way. Even a Drake couldn't stay aloft indefinitely. After flying from midnight to noon, Cirrus had the formation set down where the mountains rose, some 50 miles northwest of their objective. There were 30 Reds in all, each carrying a veteran spoiled. Hardly a mighty force, but it was important their approach not be noticed. Cirrus also calculated that the intelligence provided by the aerostat pilot before his inevitable death would more than compensate for a lack of numbers. He waited for nightfall before setting off again, skirting the northern flank of the mountains and making for the coast, whereupon the Reds made a sharp turn into the sound. They flew low over the placid waters, wary of being silhouetted against the two moons. The Mount Works soon came into view, Cirrus quickly confirming that the description of the defenses matched the mental image supplied by the pilot. Lizanne Lethbridge clearly hadn't taken the settlement's security for granted. There were 12 gun emplacements surrounding the town and the manufactory, with another 6 within, all manned day and night by the town militia. However, it was the manufactory that captured most of his interest, a large building with light streaming from its windows and open main doors, illuminating the copious steam and smoke rising from its vents.
"That must burn tonight,"
he told Forest Spear and the other spoiled.
"Everything else is secondary."
The spoiled slipped from the backs of the Reds as they neared the wharf, Cirrus tumbling from Kataris's back into the chill embrace of the Sound. It was a 300-yard swim to the docks, an easy feat for a spoiled. The hour corresponded with the turn of the two moon tide, so the current was friendly, allowing a swift approach. He kept beneath the surface for most of the journey, pausing occasionally to rise and poke his nose out of the water and draw in some air, before slipping below, leaving barely a ripple on the surface. A number of ships were moored at the wharf, freighters waiting to take the munitions manufactured here to the army in the north. Cirrus and the other spoiled dived down and swam beneath the hulls, rising on the other side to conceal themselves in the matrix of girders beneath the wharf. With the tide high, it was a short climb, Cirrus dividing the spoiled into two groups and leading one to the eastern side of the docks whilst the other went west. Cirrus scaled the girders to the edge of the platform, slowly hauling himself up to peer at what lay above, and finding himself instantly greeted by a pair of guards. They were frozen in the act of sharing a match, cigarillos dangling from their mouths as they gaped at him. Cirrus swung his body and vaulted over the edge, knife coming free of the sheath on his belt as he rolled towards the guards. One managed a half-shout before the blade slashed across his throat, whilst the other continued to gape in shock even as Cirrus stabbed him under the chin, driving the knife up into his brain. He moved on without pause, the spoiled following close behind. There were many crates stacked up around the docks, providing valuable cover as they slipped from one shadow to another. Upon clearing the docks, pairs of spoiled peeled off, moving swiftly to the gun positions they had been ordered to silence. Cirrus and Forest Spear, in company with four others, made for the manufactory. As expected, there were no people in the streets, the converted pilot having informed them of the strict curfew observed at the mount. Those not working a shift were to be afforded an uninterrupted sleep, though Cirrus wondered how that was possible with the noise produced by the manufactory. A continual clatter of metal on metal rose in volume as they approached, still keeping to the shadows and avoiding the notice of the cordon of guards surrounding the works. They paused as Cirrus checked the progress of the spoiled he had sent against the gun emplacements. Four positions had already been silenced, the gunners cut down with knife and war club before they could raise the alarm. Another seven were wiped out in the space of a few minutes. But then one of the gunners, a young woman with impressive reflexes, managed to draw her revolver in time to shoot down the two attacking spoiled. Within seconds, the piercing shriek of a siren cut through the noise of the manufactory, and lights began to flare in the windows of the houses. Cirrus sent a mental command to Kataris, calling the Reds down from their circling vigil several hundred feet above. He had known the chances of achieving complete surprise were slim, but the damage already done to the mount's defenses ensured at least half the Reds would make it through the barrage. Tracer bullets were already arcing into the air when he led the spoiled from cover, drawing his revolver and making straight for the cordon in front of the manufactory's huge open doors. The spoiled spread out on either side as he ran, firing their revolvers on the run and cutting down 10 guards. Their comrades responded swiftly with rifle and carbines, Cirrus and the other spoiled throwing themselves flat as the bullets snapped the air around them. He took the time to reload his revolver, glancing up at the familiar hiss and roar of Drake fire. Kataris swooped down out of the night sky to blast the remaining cordon of guards with his flames. He landed directly in front of the manufactory doors, two more Drakes coming to earth on either side. As one, they turned and charged into the manufactory, the noise of labor soon becoming drowned by the cacophony of many people screaming in terror. Cirrus got to his feet and led the spoiled on, leaping to the side to avoid the falling corpse of a Red that landed in his path, its hide pierced all over by cannon fire. Inside the manufactory, everything was chaos. Charred or mutilated corpses littered the rows of workbenches, and burning people ran in all directions. Katarius and his two fellow drakes were halfway along the cavern of space, belching repeated gouts of flame at the mass of people fleeing to the rear of the building. Those running for the side exits were cut down by tail strikes or bullets from the spoiled, as Cirrus led them forward in a skirmish line. He leveled his revolver at a fleeing man, putting a bullet through his head from 30 paces, then instinctively jerked away as the chest of the spoiled to his right exploded. Cirrus took cover beneath a workbench, seeing another spoiled fall, the impact of the shot that killed him powerful enough to remove his head from his shoulders. The other spoiled raised their pistols to a higher angle and returned fire, Cirrus slipping from cover to track their aim to a walkway above. A man was crouched behind some steel plating, sparks flying as the spoiled's bullets struck home. Cirrus could make out the shiny crown of the man's bald head and the barrel of the carbine he held, jerking as he reloaded. Raising his revolver, Cirrus centered the sights on the man's head, then stopped as a small round object was tossed over the steel plating, trailing smoke as it arced down to land a few feet away. Cirrus leapt with all the strength his remade limbs allowed. Even so, the grenade came close to killing him. Shrapnel buzzed the air as the blast sent him careening into a girder, Cirrus feeling the snap of breaking ribs as his chest connected with the iron pillar. He lay stunned at the foot of the girder, pain flaring in his chest with every breath. The snick of a carbine lever drew his gaze upwards, finding the man with the carbine staring down at him from the walkway. He was a stocky fellow in soot-covered overalls, and Cirrus felt a faint pulse of amusement as he scanned the man's broad features, recognizing him as one of the duo that had flown away from Theros with Tekela. "Hello," he said, though the words were probably meaningless, garbled by the blood leaking from his mouth. "A friend of Tekela's. Are you not?" Whether the man heard or even understood him, Cirrus couldn't know. In either case, being greeted by a spoiled didn't seem to stir any merciful impulse. The man swiftly brought the carbine to his shoulder, eyes dark and purposeful behind the sights as he trained them on Cirrus. Forest Spear's knife came spinning out of the grenade smoke, sinking into the bald man's neck up to the hilt. The carbine swung wide as his finger gave a final convulsive twitch on the trigger, the bullet missing Cirrus by a few inches, though the explosion of sparks as it impacted the girder sent flakes of molten steel into his face. He felt Forest Spear pulling him upright and wiped the blood from his eyes, glancing around to see the other spoiled lying dead. The interior of the manufactory was now so filled with smoke and heat, it was hard, even for his unnatural gaze, to discern the scale of the destruction. However, a bright blaze was burning at the rear of the building, the roar of the flames punctuated by exploding munitions. Cirrus was able to make out the slumped forms of two drakes, meaning they had encountered some fierce resistance during their rampage. A sudden drop in temperature made the view clearer, Cirrus catching sight of a red tearing a large rent in the manufactory's roof. He was able to recognize Katarius as the huge drake clawed his way out. Another round of explosions sounded deep in the manufactory, shaking the ground and convincing Cirrus they had done all the damage they could. He and Forest Spear rushed outside, finding the sky above the town crisscrossed by arcing lines of tracer from the surviving gun emplacements. Their fire was augmented by numerous repeating guns on the ships moored at the wharf. Cirrus saw a red fold up in midair, caught by two converging bursts of cannon fire that sent it plummeting into the streets. Another red swooped down, spewing flame at a squad of militia, then fell dead as their carbine sent a fusillade of exploding bullets into its chest. A mental survey revealed to Cirrus that he and Forest Spear were the only spoiled to survive the attack, a distinction that wouldn't last long, judging by the large number of militia streaming towards them from the town. There was a brief rumbling cry from above, followed by a gust of wind as Katarius came to earth nearby. Cirrus and Forest Spear scrambled onto his back, ducking as bullets zipped around them, and the beast sprinted forward before launching himself skyward. Katarius twisted and turned as cannon shells and bullets chased them across the sky, swooping low and banking to soar to the north end of the town, where the rising smoke and flame from the manufactory masked their escape. The drake let out a loud roar as they flew away, wings sweeping as he bore them towards the mountains. Whether it was an expression of triumph or grief for his lost kin, Cirrus couldn't tell.
Chapter 46 Lizanne. She jumped from the typhoon's gondola before it came to earth, landing hard and sprinting towards the smoking ruin of the manufactory. Some of the townsfolk called out to her, but she tore past them, only vaguely registering the corpses, drake and human, that marked her path. Several long rows of covered bodies had been placed on the flat ground before the manufactory, and teams of workers were busy carrying more from the blackened structure. Lizanne's gaze swung wildly from face to face, finally alighting on one she knew.
"My father,"
she said, rushing to grab Madame Hackigan's arm. The woman stared at her for a moment, eyes uncomprehending in her soot-stained face, then gave a helpless shake of her head.
"I don't know,"
she said in a thin whisper.
"I haven't seen him."
Lizanne left her, running to the ruin to be greeted by the dreadful carnage that lay within. Her strength seeped away, and she slowed to a stumble, moving in a daze as she took in one horror after another. A group of workers, melted together by drake fire into an obscene parody of a sculpture, clawed, stump-fingered hands reaching up to her, teeth gleaming in the charred remnants of their faces. A young assembly worker, remarkably untouched by the flames and lacking any obvious injury, lying dead beneath her workbench, face frozen in a wide-eyed mask of terror. She found the worst of it at the rear of the building. Hundreds had died here, crammed together amongst the heavy machinery as they tried to flee, only to be roasted alive. The stench of death seemed to claw its way into her being, choking nose and throat before sinking an acidic claw into her guts. The world went away for a time, everything becoming hazy and distant. When she came back to herself, she was retching air past a dry throat, staring at a pool of her own vomit. A sound came to her then, soft but easily heard in the eerie quiet. Someone was sobbing. Lizanne got unsteadily to her feet and followed the sound to the walkway above the manufactory floor, climbing up to find Tekayla weeping over the body of Jemiah Ptolemine.
"It was him,"
she said, raising a tear-streaked face to stare at Lizanne.
"A spoiled in a general's uniform," they said. "Cirrus did this. He did this because I failed to kill him."
Lizanne found she had no words for her, finding that all sensation seemed to have fled her body. She could only stand and stare in dumb fascination at the knife handle jutting from Jemiah's neck. It was a curious design, one she hadn't seen before. An intricately carved piece of bone, its elegant curve oddly pleasing to the eye.
"Lizanne!"
Professor Grayson Lethbridge stepped cautiously onto the walkway, tattered lab coat besmirched with soot and blood, though not his own as far as she could tell. He looked at Jemiah's body, face sagging in grim resignation. Lizanne's first thought was that he must be a product of her imagination, something conjured to prevent her slipping into madness. But then her father's arms enfolded her, and the freezing numbness transformed into an instant blaze of relief that had her convulsing in hard, racking sobs as she clung to him.
"Over 800 killed,"
Madame Hackigan reported.
"3 times that number wounded. About 60% of the machinery is damaged beyond repair. Fully half the stocks of recently completed munitions destroyed. The new explosives?
Lizanne asked, turning to her father.
I'm sorry, he said, shaking his head. We just completed the casing. It's mostly still intact, even salvageable. But the chemicals needed to achieve the correct explosive mix were consumed in the fire. And, Tinkerer added, the precision instruments required to manufacture the detonator.
Lizanne had found him wandering the ashen remains of what had been his workshop, expressionlessly rummaging through the detritus as he gathered various components and scraps of charred paper. Apart from a faint grimace when Lizanne inquired as to his well-being, he hadn't betrayed any particular reaction to the disaster, although she noticed he was blinking more than usual. Looking at him, she found she had to suppress a guilt-riven and unpleasant inner question. Why couldn't it have been him instead of Jemiah? She went to the window of Madame Hackigan's office, looking out at the ships in the Sound. 5 freighters had arrived that morning to collect the latest shipment of weapons and were now destined to leave half empty.
Madam, she said, I require an honest and unvarnished opinion. How long will it take before this facility can resume production? There are many variables involved.
Madam began, then fell silent as Lizanne glanced over her shoulder, gaze steady and demanding.
At this juncture,
Madam continued in a subdued tone,
too long to make any difference to the outcome of this war. Thank you.
Lizanne returned her gaze to the window and was surprised to find children at play in the park, running and laughing, seeming oblivious to the pool of smoke that still hung in the air over the mount. Just another horror witnessed in their short lives, she thought. One of many. Perhaps all this has rendered them immune to fear. It occurred to her that, win or lose, the children who would grow up in the aftermath of this war were already spoiled, in mind if not body. What kind of world will they build? But then, they can hardly do worse than we have.
Please call a general meeting of the workforce, she said, turning to face them. The Mountworks militia will sail to Gadara's Redoubt, together with any adult who wishes to volunteer for military service. Lone parents with children are excluded. And those left behind?
Madam asked.
Sufficient shipping will remain to carry them away should the need arise, though in the event of our defeat, I can't imagine a safe place where they might go. You intend to just abandon this place?
Her father asked.
A place so many have labored to exhaustion to build. There is no purpose to it now. No further contribution it can make. There are the new rockets, Tinkerer said.
Lizanne frowned at him in bemusement.
What new rockets?
They were lined up in a narrow brick shelter, which had been constructed well away from the other buildings. Exactly 300 in all, looking to Lizanne's eyes like a miniature version of the rockets that had served them so well at the Grand Cut. Each was about 1 yard long and 10 inches in diameter. They had a smooth, bullet-shaped steel warhead, and a pair of aerofoils positioned halfway along their length, with another larger pair at the base.
It occurred to me that one of the Red Drake's advantages is their ability to attack in a massed formation,
Tinkerer explained.
Rather like a swarm of bees overwhelming a larger threat. It seemed reasonable to combat one swarm with another. Swarmers,
Takela said, sinking to her haunches and running a hand along the smooth casing of the nearest rocket.
That's what we'll call them.
Lizanne detected an unfamiliar tone to Takela's voice. It had a low, hungry note to it Lizanne didn't like. Nor did she like the sight of the bone-handle knife Takela now wore strapped to her calf.
Appropriate,
Tinkerer said with a small shrug.
Each rocket contains a mechanism that compels it to follow a random course towards its target. When fired in a group, they can be set to explode at slightly different intervals.
So,
Takela said, smiling a little.
They might dodge one, but the next one gets them.
Quite so,
Tinkerer confirmed.
The materials and components required to construct another 500 have been set aside. It's just a matter of assembly.
How long?
Lizanne asked.
2 days with sufficient hands.
I'll see to it. Have them loaded when ready.
These,
she gestured at the completed swarmers,
will be fitted to the aerostats and made ready to fire immediately.
Viewed from the air, the plane below Gadara's redoubt resembled one half of a huge dartboard. Three continuous lines of trenches curved around the northern flank of the ridge, from one end of the isthmus to the other. Dust rose in thick clouds from the people at labor on the plain, Lizanne seeing the rise and fall of many shovels as she landed the Firefly within the arc of the third trench line, the other larger aerostats coming to Earth a short distance away.
It worked at Carvenport,
Arbaris explained after Lizanne had climbed down from the gondola.
Against the Corventines, she said, not the Drakes and the Spoiled.
It might have if we'd had the numbers. This is an excellent defensive position. We can place the bulk of our muzzle-loading cannon along the walls of the redoubt itself. From there they can reach any part of the battlefield. Plus, the whole trench network is within range of the fleet's guns. I wouldn't even consider an attack here given the likely butcher's bill.
Moradin would, Lizanne pointed out. And I doubt the White cares about casualties amongst its troops.
Arbaris gave a short nod of agreement.
True, but in any case, I thought our object was to hold them, not defeat them.
At this juncture, I'd be happy with any outcome that didn't involve our utter destruction.
She went on to relate the full scale of the calamity at the Mount, noting how he managed to keep any reaction from his features as he took in the news. It wouldn't do for an onlooking soldier to see their general succumb to despair.
No more munitions, he said, speaking softly and pasting a bland smile on his face.
The final consignment is on its way. Another 30 thumpers and 50 growlers, plus 100 of the new carbines. The Mount Works militia and a volunteer contingent will accompany the consignment, 5,000 strong.
All very welcome, but it's not enough.
I know.
She noticed Takela standing a short way off, eyes fixed on the plain beyond the trenches. They had given Jemiah as much of a funeral as they could before leaving the Mount. The headland east of the town had become an impromptu graveyard, marked with numerous freshly excavated graves. Tinkerer and Professor Lethbridge came to help dig Jemiah's resting place. Together they laid his canvas-shrouded body in the earth and covered him over. A few of the artificers who had worked under Jemiah's direction came to offer their respects, but the crowd was not large, there being so many funerals that day. Tinkerer marked the grave with a wooden post, onto which the words, Jemiah Ptolemine, Technologist, had been etched in precise letters. Professor Lethbridge then gave a halting, awkward eulogy, listing his colleague's many technical achievements, and thanking him for his many hours of tireless labor in service to humankind. Throughout it all, Takela had said nothing, staring fixedly at the mound of earth, eyes red in the pale mask of her face. She pulled her hand away when Lizanne tried to take it, and had maintained much the same demeanor since.
It was a long flight, Lizanne said, moving to her side. You should get some rest.
Takela ignored her, turning to Arbaris.
How long until they get here?
He paused a moment before replying, frowning as if not quite recognizing the face of a girl he had known since infancy.
2 days at most, he replied. The spoiled march with an annoying swiftness.
We should attack now,
Takela said, her gaze switching to Lazan.
With the aerostats. We can test out the swarmers. Might slow them down a bit.
We need to conserve our resources, Arbaris said.
Cirrus is their leader, isn't he?
Takela persisted.
If we can find him...
Your uncle's right, Lazan said, a tone leaving no room for argument. The swarmers will have more effect if they come as a surprise. There was a faint echo of the old pout into Kayla's expression then, but what had once been the frustration of a spoiled child was now something far more disconcerting.
He needs to die,
she whispered, voice rich in both sincerity and certainty.
And I need to kill him.
She turned and stalked away, muttering,
And he's not my fucking uncle.
At Arbaris. She feels guilty, Lizanne explained. About Jemiah.
There's plenty of guilt to go around, he said. If the history of this crisis is ever written, I suspect it might well be called the Guilty Age. The corporations, the empire, the revolution. No one in this world has clean hands anymore. Perhaps that's why it falls to us to save it.
True to Arbaris's prediction, the White's army appeared on the northern horizon by the evening of the following day. At first, it was just a rising cloud of dust, the dark specks of patrolling reds wheeling above, but the neat ranks of advancing spoiled soon resolved into focus through the lens of Lazanne's spyglass. The army proceeded along a southerly route, parallel to the trench works, stringing out in a line a mile long, before coming to an abrupt simultaneous halt and turning to face the redoubt. A good 200 yards out of range, Arbaris muttered in frustration, tracking his binoculars along the enemy line. They stood atop the tower, Lizanne's spider loaded with one of her few remaining vials of blue. Whereas they had decent but not copious stocks of the other colors, especially red thanks to the assault on the mount, blue was a fast diminishing resource. Those blood-blessed, not allocated to one of the aerostats, were seeded throughout the trench works and the fleet. They had been instructed to imbibe blue the moment the enemy began to advance, enabling Lazan to relay the orders which would coordinate the defense. The battle plan consisted of a staged withdrawal, timed to commence when Arbaris had judged each successive line of trenches to have inflicted the maximum casualties on the enemy. Upon receipt of the signal, the defenders would withdraw to the next line, under cover of the combined weight of gunnery from the cannon on the redoubt and the ships waiting a few hundred yards offshore. He estimated they could hold out for 3 days, perhaps 4 with a modicum of luck. Lizanne's last trance with Clay indicated he needed at least another 4 days to reach them, so it appeared they would have to make their own luck.
They'll wait for darkness,
Arbaris concluded as the spoiled army continued to stand immobile.
Take advantage of their freakish night vision. Best spread the word for our lot to get what rest they can.
Lazan nodded and began to press the fourth button on her spider, then stopped as Arbaris raised a hand.
Wait, they're moving.
An attack?
She asked, returning her eye to her own glass and blinking in surprise at what she saw. Instead of commencing a march towards the trenches, the spoiled were clustering into 3 large divisions, each one resembling a disturbingly well-coordinated group of ants in the way they reordered themselves into narrow columns. Lazan suspected they intended to assault the defenses in 3 places at once, hoping the narrowness of their formation would negate the effects of the firepower they faced. But then she saw the first rank of spoiled sink to their knees and begin to dig. Most had shovels, but others clawed at the ground with their inhuman hands, tearing up clods of earth and grass with a fierce, near-frantic energy. What are they doing? She wondered.
Sapping, Arbaris replied, a faint note of admiration in his otherwise grim tone. Cirrus always did know his history. Apparently it was a tactic from the early days of the Gunpowder Age, favored by armies besieging fortifications in an effort to spare their soldiers the fire of defending cannon. It had fallen out of favor with the advent of faster-firing modern artillery and repeating small arms, but Cirrus had evidently found a use for it now. The three trenches progressed across the plain with remarkable swiftness. The spoiled worked in a ceaseless relay, clawing or digging at the earth until exhaustion set in, whereupon they staggered to the rear and were immediately replaced by fresh labor. Consequently, the trenches were each close to 50 yards in length before nightfall, and the spoiled didn't show any signs of resting for the night. They'll be in range of our cannon come morning, Lizanne pointed out. A sustained barrage should impede their progress. It should, Arbaris admitted. But every shell we fire can no longer be replaced. And something tells me Cirrus is too clever to simply dig his way into our sights. He was proven correct come first light, the rising sun revealing that the forward progress of the enemy trenches had halted. Instead, they were now digging laterally, new trenches branching out from the terminus of the three already dug. By late afternoon, the White's army had a trench network of its own, whereupon all activity apparently ceased. I'd wager a sack of gold that Moradin no longer has a say over this campaign, Arbaris noted with grudging respect. Cirrus has spared his troops a good 200 yards of open ground. Even at extreme range, our cannon would have taken a fearful toll when they advanced. Plus, we would have had ample warning of the moment they decided to attack. Arbaris ordered a few of the more powerful cannon in the redoubt to try their luck at the enemy trenches, scoring a few hits. However, most of the shells went wide, and the damage inflicted was minimal. There was no answering fire from the spoiled. In fact, most sat in their trenches in placid quietude. Takela made several offers to attack in the typhoon, arguing that it would be a simple matter to rake the trenches from end to end with growler fire. Lizanne forbade it, unwilling to risk an aerostat in the massed red assault that would inevitably follow. Arbaris had the army stand on full alert throughout the night. Rocket flares supplied by the fleet were prepared all along the redoubt, ready to bathe the battlefield in artificial light when the attack came. Except it didn't. What are they waiting for? Arbaris wondered aloud come the morning, as he and Lizanne looked out at the spoiled, still sitting quietly in the trenches. As long as they keep waiting, Lizanne said, I shall consider myself satisfied. We can't become complacent. There must be a strategy at work here, something we're missing, just like the jet sands. Noting the tension in his unshaven jaws, Lizanne saw for the first time how deep the sting of defeat had wounded him. Pride, she thought, reaching out to grasp his forearm. The disease of generals and revolutionaries alike. Get some rest, she told him. I'll be sure to wake you should anything happen. Got hit by a storm last night, Clay told her. Lost sight of the Endeavor till morning. The captain had to take the Bloodburner offline. He reckons it'll be another 2 days sailing. Lizanne replied with a pulse of acknowledgement, momentarily distracted by the clarity of the shared trance. Before his newfound ability, Clay's mindscape had been somewhat basic in construction, Nelfia's surface a uniform gray, and the black sky above lacking a rendition of the planet they called home. Now it hung above them in majestic blue and green glory against an endless spectacle of stars. Kriz helped me with it, he explained, sensing her curiosity. Ain't had much else to do during the voyage.
Somehow I doubt that, she replied, enjoying the momentary thrum of embarrassment that ran through the dust. Is there a secret in my head you don't know? He asked. Thousands, I'm sure. It's not your thoughts that betray you, but your feelings. Something they used to drill into us in the academy. She gave a final glance at the planet filling the sky above, resisting the urge to lose herself in the beauty of it, even for a short time. I have to go, she told him. Our blue stocks are low. Please reiterate the need for urgency to Captain Heilmore. I do that one more time, he's like to shoot me. Clay trailed off, his gaze drawn to something beyond her. Who's she? Lizanne turned, seeing a sailing ship approaching across the mindscape, the moon dust parting like a wave before the bows. Morva was perched on the figurehead below the prow, hands cupped around her mouth as she called to Lizanne.
You have to come! It started!
Chapter 47 Cirrus Light the fuses. Cirrus watched through Forrest Spear's eyes as he touched a match to the tip of the fuse wire, igniting a ball of sparks, then tracked its fiery dance into the depths of the tunnel. He checked to ensure the fuses laid in the other two tunnels had also been lit, then returned to his own eyes, peering down from Katarius's back at the enemy trenchworks below. The captives they had taken at the jet sands had confirmed the identity of his opponent, and Cirrus would very much have liked to see Arbaris's face at the instant he realized his efforts had all been for nothing. He had never particularly cared for the Major, finding his attitude to Tekayla disconcertingly opposite to his own. Though she called him Uncle at her father's insistence, Cirrus had long perceived a lack of warmth between the two. The fact that Arbaris was half a foot taller and much admired by the female nobility of Morsvale hadn't done much to endear him to Cirrus either.
Such adolescent notions you cling to, General.
Kathleen's thought popped into his head, amused and judgmental in equal measure.
Sometimes I forget how young you were.
As do I, Cirrus admitted. It all seems so far away, like a dream of someone else's life.
As it should. We all have new lives now, for which we should be grateful.
The first mine exploded directly beneath the first line of the Restian trenches, bathing the darkened plain in yellow-orange light, Cirrus watching the debris and bodies tumble in the rising ball of flame. The size of the crater was as Veilmist had predicted, leaving a hole 30 feet wide. It had taken the Spoiled a total of 60 hours to dig the three tunnels and pack them with explosives. Arbaris had presumably expected a massed nighttime assault, which he would shortly receive, but only after the mines had done their work in piercing the outer defenses. The next two mines exploded barely 2 seconds later, with similarly gratifying results. The glow revealing 10 battalions of Spoiled, rising from their own trenches and advancing across the plain at the run. A dozen rocket flares streamed into the sky from the fortified ridgeline above the trenches, banishing the dark and heralding a barrage from the guns along the walls. Shells tore into the ranks of the attacking Spoiled, felling dozens at a time. Casualties increased as a few repeating guns opened fire from the undamaged sections of the enemy trench, inflicting heavy losses. But none of it was enough to stop the tide. The Spoiled boiled over the outer trench, Cirrus feeling the pain, joy and death of close-quarters combat as they battled the human defenders. Glimpsing the struggle through Forrest Spear's eyes, he was struck by the savagery of the Verestians, most of them eschewing firearms to fight with swords and knives, seemingly without any regard for their own survival.
Pirate scum,
Kathleen surmised, taking the measure of the Verestian's clothing. Pirate scum with an inconvenient amount of courage, Cirrus replied, noting the continued fighting all along the trench. Frenzied melees were raging in each of the craters, and the trench itself was choked with spoiled and humans locked in desperate combat. As yet, he could see no evidence of the hoped-for flight to the second trench line. The fiercest resistance came wherever the enemy had placed a bloodblast, the Verestians clustering around them as they blasted the attackers with red and black, some leading desperate countercharges with sword or clubbed rifle in hand, the green in their veins making them more than a match for any spoiled. A swift survey of mines revealed a spot close to where the first mine had exploded, which appeared to be free of bloodlust. Cirrus immediately ordered another 4 battalions into the attack, aiming them at this point. They streamed across the plain, covering the distance with a speed no human could match, but that didn't spare them the attentions of the Verestian gunners or their fleet. The cannon on the redoubt kept up a steady fire, but the most damaging barrage came from the ships offshore. Shells arced down in a continuous torrent, aimed with expert precision, to explode above rather than amongst the advancing spoiled. The lead battalion was cut to pieces in the barrage, only about a fifth of them managing to press home their attack, whilst the battalions following behind fared little better. However, the sudden arrival of additional numbers at the crucial point finally told, and soon spoiled were spilling through into the flat ground beyond the trench. A plethora of bugle calls and shouted orders ran the length of the trench, evidently the signal for the defenders to withdraw. In an obviously pre-rehearsed maneuver, the humans abandoned the struggle and immediately sprinted towards the second line, whilst the Verestian ships lowered their sights to rake the conquered trench in shellfire. The spoiled, who had broken through on the left, pelted towards the second line, only to be met by a hail of fire from well-positioned repeating guns. None of them managed to get within 20 yards of the trench, and Cirrus ordered the survivors to withdraw to the first line. The shipborne fire continued, Cirrus feeling the death or maiming of multiple spoiled with every exploding shell. It petered out as the flares guttered and died, leaving the battlefield mostly in darkness, save for Nelfia's glow. Small arms fire continued to crackle as sharpshooters in the second trench and the redoubt trained their long rifles on the first trench, though they scored only a few hits.
"A good start, don't you think?" Kathleen asked.
"I had hoped to take the second trench in the first assault," Cirrus replied. "We need to do something about those ships." A singular paradox of being in proximity to the White was that he didn't need to engage with the increasingly difficult task of summoning fear to mask his thoughts. Being close enough to smell the sulphurous breath of the beast and see the awful, knowing gleam of its eyes birthed all the terror he could ever need. As before, he felt the communication between Kathleen and the White rather than heard it as thought speech. The deep lust for vengeance that had characterized its thoughts ever since the loss of the infants at the Grand Cut was still present in full force, but the intervening time had also seen a resurgence of the beast's innate cunning. It responded with a disconcerting rumble as Kathleen communicated the essence of Cirrus's plan. Whilst it never balked at casualties amongst the spoiled, risking the lives of so many drakes was another matter. Smoke streamed from the White's nostrils as it turned about, pacing back and forth. It had established itself on the summit of a hilltop, the only high ground to be found on the plain. It offered an uninterrupted view of the fortified isthmus a mile away, where its quarry waited. The 2 surviving infants were at work close by on one of their bone towers, squawking in apparent contentment as they fused the remains together with regurgitated bile. Cirrus assumed the bones had been supplied by the other drakes, fruits of their labor at the jet sands.
"Necessity,"
Kathleen emoted, receiving a pulse of angry reluctance in response, as the White turned its baleful gaze on them, Cirrus noting the small sparks amidst the smoke rising from his nostrils. He had never before sought to intervene in a communication between Kathleen and the White, but did so now. Summoning all the memories he could of Lizanne Lethbridge, he entwined them with the image of the dead infant Whites, condensing it all into a dark ball of sensation before offering it to Kathleen.
Revenge, she thought, accepting Cirrus's gift, breaking the ball of memory apart so it expanded in the White's mind.
For the briefest moment, Cirrus was able to share the link between them, experiencing it as an image of a dark, roiling sea of fire shot through with veins of light. Wherever the light touched the fire, the flames calmed, became placid, taking on a semblance of order. That's what he needs her for, he realized. She calms the storm of his mind, allowing true intelligence to blossom. The White gave a grunt of annoyance at the intrusion, and Cirrus found himself shut out. The jarring sense of disconnection was accompanied by a bolt of punishing agony that sent him to his knees, teeth clenched. The pain lingered for a time, preventing him from following the rest of the communication. When it faded, he felt Kathleen's hands on his face, fingers wiping the pain-induced tears from his scaled skin. She smiled and pressed a kiss to his forehead, speaking softly.
He said, yes.
Chapter 48 Hylemore.
Land in sight, sir! Dead ahead!
Thank you, Mr. Talmont. Tell the chief to take the Bloodburner offline and signal the Endeavour to follow suit.
Aye, sir.
Hylemore went outside and trained his glass to westward, making out the misted slopes of an island cresting the horizon. If his calculations were correct, this was the most easterly islet of the Cerberus chain. Navigating the channel through the islands to the red tides was not a task that could be performed at speed, necessitating another delay. The storm that had swept across their path 3 days before had been mild by the standards of the Erethic, but the seas it produced were sufficiently steep to force a reduction in speed. Since then, Hylemore found his mood veering between frustration at the lack of progress and a small, barely acknowledged kernel of relief he knew stemmed from the battle off the Green Cape. Steelfine insisted on recording the engagement as a victory in the ship's log, one the rest of the crew seemed to consider the equal of anything won by Hylemore's grandfather. He knew differently. No admiral who loses his fleet can be counted a victor of anything. If the Superior didn't reach Gadara's redoubt in time for Clay to attempt his plan, a plan Hylemore still didn't fully understand, he might well consider it a reprieve rather than a failure. He had already studied the charts of the Northern Erethic in preparation for a voyage to Sonora, where he felt sure Free Woman Tythoncroft would offer refuge to the valiant crew of the Superior. And then what? He asked himself. Sit and wait for the White's army to appear, however long it takes, all the time knowing yourself to be a miserable coward. He closed his spyglass with a hard snap and returned to the bridge house.
Ever sailed the red tides, Mr. Scrimshine?
He inquired of the helmsman.
A few times, skipper.
The former smuggler gave a small, wary smile.
Didn't find it the friendliest place, truth be told. Berestians love to steal, but hate to be stolen from. Kind of hypocritical of them, if you ask me.
Indeed so. I'll trust you to choose the best approach to the channel. I require a swift but safe navigation to the red tides. Mr. Talmont, ask Chief Bosware to join me in the hold. You have the bridge.
Don't seem big enough to do much damage, Clay said, squinting at the apple-sized object the chief placed on the workbench.
Got enough of a charge to kill a drake of any size,
Bosware replied, his oily brows forming a peaked frown.
Gun cotton laced with lamp oil around a core of black powder. Made the casing deliberately brittle, so it'll shatter into sharp pieces when it goes off. Jagged iron'll cut through anything if it's traveling fast enough.
What are these?
Chris asked, extending a finger to one of the blunt spikes protruding from the device's casing.
Contact points, the chief said. Got the notion from those mines the captain